Okay, this is an interview with Joseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, R. Burgard, B-U-R-G-A-R-D, 859 Northwest Knoll Drive, that's capital W-E-S-T, capital K-N-O-L-L Drive, Los Angeles, California. What's the zip code here? 90069, and that's Los Angeles, California, and the phone number is area code 213-652-7957.
Right.
We are in the living room of Mr. Burgard's home here in West Hollywood, and my wife is present, as well as Mr. Burgard and myself, and it is July the 29th, 1976, Thursday. And it's about 7 minutes after 7 p.m. And Mr. Burgard was kind enough to take the time to see me this evening. And I'm going to show him some pictures and talk because he was with Lockheed Radio Department how many years?
I knew you were going to ask some questions.
Well, take him up. Well, about what year did you go to work for Lockheed?
Around 35, I think.
Around 1935. Yeah. Don't worry about this thing. You'll forget about it. You were a radio man. Radio engineer?
No, I started out in final assembly, and was switched over to the radio department to assist in conduit and wiring installation, this sort of thing, and gradually worked in radio installation.
Who was the number one man in your department in those days?
Bill Burroughs.
Bill Burroughs.
Uh-huh.
And were you number two man?
I was acting as straw boss for quite a long time there.
Okay. In 1936, a Lockheed 10 was coming down the line. Number 1055. And this was an airplane that had been ordered in the Lockheed 10E configuration, and it was ordered by a very famous young lady flyer at the time, named Amelia Earhart Putnam. And this is what I want to try and jog your memory about, what work you did in final assembly and radio in regards to Amelia's airplane, or anything that you know about it. Did you know Amelia personally?
Not really. I'd met her a few times around the aircraft. Never to talk to, or visit with, or anything like that.
You have something written down there.
Well, yeah, I remember this old notebook that I had, in which I had listed the numbers of the Model 10s as they were coming through.
Uh-huh.
And I have noted 55. Well, 1055 originally, and marked Earhart. Rebuilt delivery May 11th, 1937. Now, I don't recall what happened, but apparently there was a crack up or some damage done to the craft, and it was rebuilt, and I noted the delivery date of May 11th, 1937. Then another notation I found was number 55 was K-H-A-Q-Q, lost July 3, 1937. Now, K-H-A-Q-Q, I believe, was her station call letters for that aircraft. And I also noted Fred Noonan, navigator.
Did you know
I said about Amelia, I met them around the plane a few times, just not to speak to her and talk with. But just to know who they were, mainly. Another thing, you asked me about Bill Burroughs this afternoon, and I said that I didn't think his son's name was Bill, but we remembered later that it was. I remember he called him Billy. And at the time, I was confused with Biff Marshall's son, who was, I think we called Butch. And I had the two confused. And I found a notation also that the last, apparently the last place I knew of where Bill was in care of W.R. Harrell, H-A-R-R-E-L-L, at 358 South Odell Avenue, Marshall, Missouri.
Okay, just a second. Sometime around the middle of 1936 at Burbank, and she picked the airplane up, and she was flew it back. She entered the Bendix Trophy race with it, and she flew it back to Purdue, and she was working kind of with Purdue University at the time. And but mainly she just flew it around the United States, and she kept it at Paul Mance's hangar when it was in Burbank, but it was only there part of the time. And she had a mechanic that was with her from the time practically that she took delivery in the airplane, the name of Bo McNeely.
And Bo, I don't remember him.
He used to fly around with her, and he used to work. Well, he worked over at Mance's hangar mostly. And Bo worked for Amelia by the month. She paid him by the month, and he worked strictly for her, though he would do odds and ends for Mance, too. And then she took the airplane back to Teterboro, New Jersey, and they installed, Western Electric installed some radio equipment back there. And then she brought the airplane back to Burbank. And then she announced she was going to make a trip around the world flying at the equator. And her and a fellow by the name of Harry Manning, who was a captain for the United States line, and even a pretty good radio operator, he knew how to use the code and everything, they worked out a deal where they could get 500 kilocycles on this as well as 3105 and 6210 voice, and then CW 500 kilocycles. And she went back again to the East Coast, and on the way she stopped at South Bend, Indiana, and talked to Bendix. And Bendix was just coming out with a whole new line of gear. They picked up Hillard of Chicago. They picked up Radio Research Company of Washington, D.C., and they had a brand new receiver and a brand new transmitter and a brand new direction finder. From three different companies, they were putting them all together under the Bendix name and coming out with the Bendix line. And so they put together some sets for her, and a fellow by the name of Pearl Remlin came out from Washington with a direction finder, and they shipped out a new Bendix receiver, and that was installed by the Lockheed engineers at Lockheed just the first part of March 1937, as she was getting ready for that trip around the world.
You know, it's interesting because I just couldn't recall the equipment was in her plane, whether it was Western Electric or Bendix or what it was.
Yeah, I'm going to show you
some pictures. No, I put the most of it in.
I'm going to show you pictures of the installations and everything, and that'll probably jog your memory. You're going to see some things here that'll be fun, I think. She flew the flight to Honolulu with Paul Mance, Harry Manning, and Fred Noonan. He joined him at the last minute. And when they got to Honolulu, Mance got off, and Amelia was taking off, and on the takeoff, ground hooked the airplane and wiped the gear out from underneath it and wrecked one of the wings and the cells. And they shipped it back on the Lurline, back to the factory for repairs, and she came back even earlier on the Malola. And they threw it into the factory, and they did a real heavy rush job on it, and in about 6 weeks had the thing ready to fly. About May 11th, they delivered it back to her. And in the meantime, they worked on the antenna a little bit, but I don't know if you know anything about that. Joe Gurr had built a special coupler, antenna coupler, so that he could hook 500 KCs up to the flat top. And so they wouldn't have to use the training wire, because the training wire had to be hand-reeled in and out from way in the back. And, of course, she couldn't do that by herself at all. It had to have someone in the back to do it. So she wouldn't have 500 KCs unless she could get it hooked up to the flat top. So he made this antenna coupler. And then they took off and decided to change the route instead of going to Honolulu to go via Miami. And so her and her husband and Fred Noonan and Bo McNeely took off, and they went up to Oakland and back down to Burbank. Then they went to Tucson, El Paso, New Orleans, and Miami. When she got to Miami, she was having two problems with the airplane. So she got the people at Pan American to work on the airplane. One of the problems was that she was not getting out on 3105 and 6210 very well. And so the radio men went to work on her radios. The other problem was that the rudder control on the Sperry did many test flights. She swung the compasses. She worked on this radio problem, and they finally got everything fixed about a week later, and she left on her final flight around the world, and it was almost June 1st. It was over a month later. It was actually on July 2nd when she was en route from Ley, New Guinea to Howland Island that they disappeared on that flight and have been forever lost.
It was July 3rd, I mentioned.
You said 3rd.
That's when we heard about it.
Okay, so that's a bit of the background. Now I'm going to start showing you some pictures. You'll have to excuse my... This is a picture of her airplane just about as it was delivered in 1936. The only radio equipment that I notice here is there are two antennas, one connected to the starboard pitot and one to the port pitot, going back to two stands back here, and the starboard one has a middle post there. Also on top, there is something that looks like a direction finder housing.
This is what's causing, and I couldn't recall what it was on the top or the bottom of that craft because many of them were installed on the bottom, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of a, you know, circa 1936, what kind of a loop housing was that?
It was, I don't know if this is like most of the rest. It doesn't look the same as the most that were installed on those craft in those days. They were about a, as I recall, a 7-inch diameter in the center and shaped like a, sort of like a torpedo.
Those were a little later models.
Yeah, perhaps so. Now, I wonder if this was something that Western Electric had done.
No.
It looks like a plastic housing.
Yes, that is a clear plastic housing with some sort of loop inside. I'll tell you what Bill there told me, what he thought it was. Let me remind you of another airplane. You remember a fellow by the name of Dick Merrill, who was a pilot for Eastern Airlines?
The name rings a bell.
Okay, well, Dick, in 1936, flew a Vol-T, single-engine Vol-T, to Spain. Some woman hired him, something to stop the war in Spain or something. And on the top of that, his airplane, the Vol-T, he had this radio compass thing installed. And it was installed at Long Beach by a gentleman over there. And Bill Lear said that this was a radio designed by someone here in Los Angeles who was out peddling it around and convincing people that he had a real fine direction finder. And it was a good idea and a good-looking thing, but it didn't work. And it would be installed on various airplanes. They'd fly around with it for a while, then take it off because it was a great idea, but it didn't work.
You don't know who it was?
He doesn't know who Bill can't remember who it was.
Could it have been Dick's daughter?
It could have been.
You know him.
I know the name.
Well, he's a man when it was Howard Hughes.
Dick Stoddard, Stoddard. Or Odard.
Leave it in the T, Stoddard. I
see.
Like that. I don't...
Was he around in those days, in the 30s?
When was that Hughes flight? That was later.
Just after this, a couple years later.
Sometime later, because it was Model 14.
Right. Did you install that?
This rig? Compass, you mean?
You remember that loop housing at all?
No, I don't. I recall working on the junction boxes and the internal wiring and these antennas.
What these two antennas down here?
Well, I think that one you pointed out the right one, isn't it?
The
lead-in pulls off the center.
Well, I don't know about the lead-in pulls off the center, but it has a center post.
Well, I think that was the directional antenna.
Antenna?
I believe so.
I see. And what would the port one have been for?
communications receiver.
Just a plain old receiver to receive the range signal. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, does that, do you see anything in that picture that reminds you of anything? I mean, just... For instance, you mentioned the hatch.
Yeah, there was an opening.
Right. A
movable hatch, an opening hatch.
Little funny vents here, those are...
Well, the windows, they were removed.
Yeah. Those were fuel vents. Fuel fillers.
Yeah, because
for
the tanks were mounted in the fuselage, weren't they?
Yes, they were. I'll show you a picture of that. Okay. Now I'm going to show you some pictures inside the airplane. Now this is Amelia on top of the tanks. And this is some of the tanks and a piece of plywood on top of that. And then you'll notice that there's a unit here. Do you recognize? And she has her hand up a piece of radio gear there of some kind that's on the starboard side, sitting up on top of the tanks. Do you recognize that gear at all?
No, I don't. The only thing I can imagine it is the direction finder receiver.
Okay, now you notice it has some wires that come up to here, to this portion here, which would appear about where that unit is.
Loop lead in.
Then you believe that this is very possibly the receiver and whatnot for this direction finder.
I would guess. No, what's this?
Yeah, that's a fuel vent. These are the common vent lines here, and it comes up to the scuppery drain here for the vent. This somehow or other comes back behind there to here. And is it possible that this is two units, a transmitter unit? Because I noticed another wire coming out over here.
Not only that, here's a dynamo showing up here. Would seem like it would indicate a transmitter, possibly, but I don't. I guess those receivers had dynamos built into them, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
That's right.
12-volt systems.
See, it's been so darn long since I fooled.
Right, it'll come back. I'm going to show you a lot more pictures. Okay. Well, this looks like very possibly this comes from the loop housing up there. This plastic loop housing. Okay, and I'm going to show you another picture. And this picture was taken at Teterboro, New Jersey, around the 1st of February, 1937. And this shows a fellow by the name of Carl Remlin, R-E-M-M-L-E-I-N. And he worked for Bendix Radio Corporation as a sales engineer of some sort. And this is Amelia, of course. This is her airplane. And this is Harry Manning. This here, you recognize that at all?
No, I only recognize, I think it's a transmitter from the appearance of it.
Well, the dials are kind of silvery color, so it looked like dials, but those are really cranks.
Oh, I see.
This is the original RA-1 receiver.
Oh, uh-huh.
This is numero uno, number one.
Oh, yeah.
Designed by Moore and Malcolm Taylor. Okay. Well, this...
Vernon Moore, yeah, I knew him.
Vernon designed this receiver.
I don't remember, I don't recall Taylor.
Well, Malcolm Taylor worked for Bendix till the day he retired.
Yeah, but
he worked
Vernon Moore, I remember. If I remember correctly, Moore came out here to work.
That's right.
Later, yeah.
Hey, he
was in
Studio City.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He'd be tickled to death in the studio sometime. Well, he designed... Amelia saw Bendix in South Bend, came out, and then Remlin showed her their unit and described it to her, and she decided, okay, we'll have that unit. But she wanted it to cover certain frequencies and whatnot. She wanted it to cover from about 200 kilocycles clear through to 10 megacycles. Mm. So Vernon Moore and Malcolm Taylor had to specially modify it, and they had to redesign all the coils in the front end and track everything.
Mm.
And in those days, everything was done manually, and get it out to her. Well, on February 25th, he finished the job, and he air-expressed it to Burbank. Carl Remlin shows up on about the 3rd of March, 1937, and he brought with him the Bendix RDF-1, which is really the Navy DW direction finder, and a control matching box, which was designed to match this with the RA-1 receiver. And he shows up with Amelia, and the newspapers report that the Lockheed engineers are installing the new Bendix direction finder in her airplane. This is a blow-up of that control box that he has in his hand. Do you remember this unit at all?
I just saying to myself, I can't believe I remember so little about what went on. I don't recall the unit specifically.
Okay. Well, now let me show you another picture. This picture here is of the same general area, but this picture was taken after the installation of the previous gear that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
This here is the power supply for the RA-1 receiver.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that is right behind it there.
I can't.
It's just a black box, and I can't tell what it is.
Well, I'm afraid I can't help you with that either.
Okay, do you notice something here? Where our direction finder housing
is. That's covered now, I see. Uh-huh. What, did you put the loop on the bottom then?
No, the loop was mounted right up forward of the hatch right in the center.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, it's a manual.
It was manually turned.
That's right, right on the bottom of it. Yeah. Just turn it. All right, I'll show you a picture.
Crank the wheel and the azimuth.
We're all just right inside the skin of the airplane here. And it was right over the center of the cockpit, right over their head.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this here is a picture of just after the tanks. And this shows Harry Manning and Amelia inside the airplane at the navigation station. They have an altimeter, an air temperature gauge, and an airspeed indicator. And they mounted a Polaris up here on the window. Also, you notice this unit here? It's right underneath the navigation table that Amelia is sitting on. Do you recognize that at all?
No, I don't.
Well, I don't believe it's a radio.
It doesn't appear to be.
Well, what does it look like to you?
You got me.
Well, I believe it's a battery.
It does look like a battery, doesn't it?
I think that's a battery box and is your battery lead.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I think this was her spare battery. But you notice something here? You notice this obviously is a antenna line with very heavy shielding. I don't think it's coaxial, so I think it's a transmitting antenna line because it's held off by little insulators and a very heavy insulation. And the antenna post through the skin insulator was just forward of this battery case down underneath the table, and it came up to the outside to the flat top antenna from that position, just forward of that window there.
Well, if that was the lead-in insulator,
I thought it's just the end of the wire. It's just sitting there right now.
But you said the insulator was below this.
Below this table and forward, kind of about a foot or so forward and right, right about the table level or just under the table.
Didn't she have a V transmitting antenna?
Yes, on top of it.
From a post above the cockpit to the fins.
That's correct.
That
and they
was
fed off to the starboard side.
Yeah, that was pretty much of a standard installation, as I recall.
Okay. Now I'll show you. I think that just about covers the various parts of the radio installation. Yeah, that does. Well, did you install this antenna, the loop up on top?
It's very possible, but I can't specifically recall it.
All right, now I'm going to show you.
I did so much varied, so many varied things on installations.
Okay, now these pictures here were taken before the installation of the loop, because the loop was installed right up here.
Right.
and just forward of this crank. I'm guessing that that is a rudder trim tab, possibly an elevator, but more likely a rudder trim tab. And then it was just forward of that they installed it. Also, instead of having this hatch open this way, they eventually hinged it up here and it opened the other way.
Let's see what.
They did that at a later date. Okay.
I didn't recall when it opened.
It did that because she got out on the wing, and the, having the hatch over here got in the way. And because of the tank, she found it difficult to get out, so they she went in and out of the cockpit over the wing, and so they changed the hatch to hinge the other way. Okay, now, I can identify some of this stuff, but I don't know, maybe you can. You recognize that at all there? I can show you a little bigger blow-up of that if you want.